Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, December the 4th, 2025, and this is episode 3,770 of the Survival Podcast. Today we are going to have an expert council Q&A show for the week, and I've got a good lineup of experts for you today. Leading off the expert panel, as is typical, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul will talk about how they're not even trying to hide how ridiculous war with Venezuela is at this point. The left is going nuts right now with that issue over, did we, you know, do a second pass on a boat and, you know, they want Hegseth's head and whatever. I'm sure Hegseth actually made no calls whatsoever at all during that attack. That's a separate issue, though, from a land war with Venezuela. It's one of the most retarded things I've ever heard in my life. I haven't heard what Dr. Paul and Chris have to say about it yet, but when we do that one, I guarantee I won't disagree with their assessment of how stupid it is. But I may disagree with their assessment of how likely it is. We shall see. But I'll tell you why I don't think it's actually likely to happen, though there might be a drug lab or two blown up, and I'm sure it's long enough in my past. I can tell you how I absolutely know that the United States government can identify where drug labs are in jungles. I don't mean I think I know. I mean I know. I'll tell you all about it. Then Kerry Brown will talk about foraging for tubers. Joel Riles will talk about training dogs on moving in and out of doorways in a way that when I first saw the segment, I forgot about the question and I wasn't really sure what they meant. But this is not like the dog getting hung up at the doorway or something, because that can be an issue too. Some dogs get really aggressive in transitions as well if like something's on the other side of it. No, this is about who goes first. And why? And I really agree with Joel's answer on this one. I did have a chance to listen to it in the prep. But then Annie McCann, I actually have several in the can for Andy, some reserves. This one just came in yesterday. He answered it right away, and I'm moving it to the front for a very selfish reason. My wife is all over this topic, red light therapy. So I know Andy has a lot of information on this, but his wife has more information on it. You'll hear about that from him and what's coming from him soon involving his wife, assuming she says yes. But I moved this one to the top of the queue just for my wife. So there's a lot of wife action going on there. Then Mike Melito has thoughts on deer hunting with a shotgun. He makes an assumption about me that turns out to be absolutely correct in this response, and we'll talk about that one. And then we have a question for newest member of the expert council, who I really like this dude, Antonio Gatto. How do you find a good and fair-priced handyman? That's a really important question. He, in fact, says it's the question, and I agree, not just for people that are in real estate like Antonio is, because you don't want to have to do everything yourself, but for homeowners. It's always been one of the most valuable things I can ever find is a handyman that I can call. I know he'll show up when I call him. I know he'll do good work. And I didn't listen to Antonio's segment yet. I'm going to listen with you guys. But one of my most important things is, will he tell me when he's in over his, like, you don't want me to do this, right? Or I can try to do this, but here's my limitations. And I want you to, like, if those, that's the most important thing. I do not want somebody saying yes to something as though they're really good at it when they've never done it before. And that's been one of my hang-ups in finding really good handymen. And then I have a gun question. And I this was sent to me. I kicked it to Mike. Mike kicked it right back to me. He says, actually, I'd like to know what you think about this. And he gave me the very short version of his opinion. And we agree on it. But I'm going to give you more details with it. And the question is, what do I think of the new Marlin lever action Trapper? It's a beautiful gun, by the way. But specifically in 10mm auto. And I'm going to start with this. I love the 10mm automatic. And I love all pistol caliber carbines. And I love lever actions, both in pistol and rifle calibers. I love all three of those things. that doesn't necessarily mean that it makes sense for them all to go together. Okay? Yeah. You can kind of start to think of where I'm going to go with that, but I'll lay it out for you why I, in particular, would not invest in this gun, even though there's been many people who have made pistol caliber carbines, and my first two questions are, does it come in 10mm? And followed by, when will it come in 10mm dummies? And yet, I'm not really excited about this one. It'll make perfect sense, I think, as to why when we get to it. Before that, I just want to remind you of a few things. Number one, it's a great time of year to be thinking about what you're going to pick up for Christmas and order so it comes to your house and it's already there and you can give it to somebody on the big day without doing it last minute. And that means you're probably going to do some shopping. And that probably means you're going to shop online. And if you're going to shop online, then you probably are going to end up shopping at Amazon. Or maybe if you're buying some tools or something like that, maybe a company called Vavor. If you're doing that for either one of those places, begin your online shopping at tspaz.com. And no matter what you buy, you'll help us out. You can find all the stuff I recommend. If you're looking for something, you can go through all the alphabetical categories at tspaz, and you can find the things I actually recommend there. The things that I can tell you work that I spent my own money on, or I wouldn't recommend them to you. And if you've noticed over the years, as I add items to tspaz, it's usually something like, I found this a couple months ago, and now I'm bringing it to you. Because if I order something and it works right away, unless it's something I can just look at it and tell there will be no problems, if it's electronic or something like that, it has to go through at least a month of its paces before I'm comfortable recommending it. So if you see a recommendation there, it is solid. And so it's a good place to do all your shopping online. It's also a good place to do your Christmas shopping. You'll help the show out, and it doesn't cost you any extra money whatsoever. And while you're there, one of the things you can buy on Amazon is my book, which is still on sale, at least for another week, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirko. I want to thank everybody that's purchased the book and done reviews of the book. And if you've bought the book and you liked it, you haven't done a review yet on Amazon, please consider doing that for me. It really helps. It's great. We're close to almost 100 reviews on an independently published book that's only been published for like 5 months. That's pretty damn rare on Amazon. So I thank you for that. A great deal, but I could use some more reviews. That would really help us out. With that, let's go ahead and drop in and hear what Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini have to say with about the ridiculousness of war with Venezuela.
We believe that this entire operation is blatantly illegal. You can't just blow people out of the water because you suspect them of a crime, regardless of what that crime is, regardless if they're running drugs or whatever they're running. You have to stop them. They have to be arrested. People say, well, why are we wasting our time doing that? Because the next time you may be in that boat fishing and you're going to get blown up. So there's a reason for these things. But nevertheless, now the reason people are talking is just as you introduced it, Dr. Paul, because apparently, and this was a story that the Washington Post ran with a few days ago, a strike held back in September. As you say, there were two survivors. They were clinging to the wreckage of the boat, and Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, or War, whatever he wants to be called, reportedly said, kill them all. And so they went back and did a second strike and killed the survivors, which is blatantly, by any accounts, an illegal act to do. And I'll show you, actually, according to the Pentagon's own rules of engagement, is illegal. So now that's a big story. And it's not just Democrats playing for political points, of course they are, but also Republicans are now starting to get nervous about this because the public is overwhelmingly against attacking Venezuela. They don't support this war, and they're starting to sour a little bit on the idea that we've killed 80 people and we have no idea who they are or what they were doing.
What if there was one of these rules that when you go to war, you should be under threat of a foreign power coming in? Were there going to be troops coming into Florida? I mean, I wonder what their plan was. But this is so disgusting.
Well, what's frustrating about this whole thing is that they're not even really trying to make sense anymore, you know. With Saddam and with all the other war propaganda, they at least tried to make it make sense. This doesn't make sense. Trump is telling us on the one hand, well, I got to blow up these boats. I got to bring the entire, you know, a huge a portion of our Navy off the coast of Venezuela because I've got to stop this drug trafficking in the U.S. Then someone says, well, it doesn't come from Venezuela. I don't care. And then what else does Trump do? He pardons the former president of Honduras who literally trafficked 400 tons of cocaine into the United States. We talked about it yesterday. So they're not even trying to make it make sense. On this hand, I've got to stop drug trafficking. On this hand, I've got to let this drug trafficker go.
You said that the follow-up strike was lawful. What law is it that allows no survivors?
The strike conducted on September 2nd was conducted in self-defense to protect Americans and vital United States interests. The strike was conducted in international waters and in accordance with the law of armed conflict.
So hold on a second. Now, that's from the judge's show. He played that. So she asked, well, what law allows you to kill the survivors? Well, self-defense. And then she said the law of wars. Let's just go ahead to this. This is actually the Defense Department's Law of War Manual. These are their laws. Go to the blue one so we can just show the cover. Now, she claimed that this manual says that you can kill survivors of a shipwreck. This is the active Department of Defense Law of War Manual. It's very long, over 1,500 pages, very detailed, right? She claimed that it says you can do that. You can kill survivors. Well, go to the one previous because he's got out of order. If you go to this section, it's section 18.3.2.1, it is very clear. It says the requirement to refuse to comply with orders to commit law of war violations applies to orders to perform conduct that is clearly illegal or orders that the subordinate knows, in fact, are illegal. And I highlight this part. For example, orders to fire upon the shipwrecked would be clearly illegal. That's their own law of war, Dr. Paul. It's clearly illegal, even though Carolyn Leavitt said it's perfectly legal.
I guess I wasn't clear on what this segment was about. I thought this segment was supposed to be about war with Venezuela. Not specifically this Boatgate thing that they're turning it into. I mostly agree with this, but I'm gonna disagree is this action illegal? And here's what I'm gonna tell you. I wish that it were. It's not. It's not, because this is not being done under war powers or what have you. They'll call it war. But they're doing this under the fact that they have designated these people terrorists. Now, you can debate whether this should be legal, and I don't think it should, to be very clear. But by precedent, not president, precedent, from what has been done in the past and how it's been interpreted in the past, with actions by Barack Obama literally assassinating not just people designated terrorists, but people who were United States citizens on foreign soil, and none of these people that seem to have a problem with this now had a problem with that then, I'm sorry. Our law is so fucked up that once you designate an organization a terrorist organization, you can get away with almost anything, and there's a lot of ways this can be played and spun to where it remains legal. You're not going to get a impeachment accomplished under the current structure of the House of Representatives, and no matter what happens in the midterms, that's not going to happen either. And if anybody gets hung out to dry in this, it's not going to be Hegseth, and it's not going to be Trump. It's going to be the admiral that actually gave the order, because when you're involved in an operation like this, and only tiny pea brains with no understanding of how military operations work, most of whom have obviously never served, or tiny pea brains who believe everything that they're told, or believe every TV show or movie they watch, like every operation like this has a whole bunch of guys sitting in a situation room going, well, sir, what do we do next? Now, the admiral is a high enough authority to give the order. So I can't remember the admiral's name, but if anybody gets hung out to dry here, it's going to be him. It's going to be him, because he was the one monitoring the situation. He's the one that gave the order. The order that was given by Hegseth, apparently, was to destroy everything, to kill everything. And Trump's been very careful with how he's answered this. What I actually wanted this to be about, because I wanted to speak to this, right? And again, I hope nobody thinks I'm saying it's okay. I hope not one person got it's okay out of that. Legal and okay are different. Legal and okay are different. Yeah? But Dr. Paul knows more than you. I think sometimes people like Dr. Paul and Chris let what they want to be true override what is true. I'm sorry, I do. I cannot find a way to make this action in of itself illegal, though I think that is a big part of by design. My other side of this is just we got the freaking giant aircraft carrier floating around out in the Gulf of America, right? And we got all these military ships. Honestly, not for the intended purpose. I wish they were all like that. I wish our United States military, our Navy, was all over our own coastlines and out to at least, you know, maybe the furthest out is our territories. Instead of policing the Persian Gulf, policing the freaking the China, South China Sea and all this other shit, I wish that's what we did with our... Like, that's not the problem. The problem is we're talking about going to war with a country that we have no business going to war with again. But I don't think we're going to. The memory of people is dramatically short. Remember how we were going to make Canada the 51st state? And we were going to take over Greenland and go to war with Denmark if we had to? I don't understand what's going on with Trump's head. I don't know what he's playing at. And the reality is, I don't know why he's doing this. Just blowing these drug boats up. I really don't. They should be, I agree with Dr. Paul and Chris, they should be arresting these people. And if they want to call them terrorists, there's a lot of ways you could just not send them back to Venezuela or wherever the hell they're from. But they're not fishermen. And I love Chris, but I'm going to say this, Chris. Stop the fishing bullshit. None of these boats are fishermen. None of these boats are fishermen, and we've made no indication we're going to blow somebody up. You are not going to get blown up in a boat, Chris. I am not going to get blown up in a boat while we're fishing. That is not going to happen. We don't need to go there to say that this is wrong and immoral. We can disagree on the legality, but I don't think we're going to go to war with Venezuela or invade Venezuela. I do think we may conduct strikes in Venezuela, which I'm going to say right now we should not do. But I am going to tell you that I absolutely know 100% for a fact that the United States military had the capability of positively identifying drug labs in the jungle under triple canopy all the way back in 1992. Because I was involved with a project in coordination with the DEA to determine if it could be done. I won't say specifically how. It was never, you know, I wasn't read in. There was no kind of like, this is a top secret thing. But it was very clear that just, you don't need to talk about it. But I can tell you that I was involved with a project at the time. I was a mechanic. All I was doing was taking care of equipment. But it was a controlled experiment to determine if it could be done. And the answer was a definitive yes. And could it be accurate to the point where if we say it's a drug lab, it's probably a drug lab, not something else. And if they could do that then, what they could do today would be light years ahead of it. So, I don't know. This one doesn't do us a lot of good right now. Let's talk about something that's a little bit more useful for modern survivalism, like foraging, and specifically this time of year, tubers with Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Gary here from Strong Roots Resources, and it's time to talk about tubers. So, as you may have noticed, the way it tends to work with foraging is the parts of the plant that generally have the most nutrient density and nutritional value are the parts that are most active rather than dormant. So, just like you think about your early spring greens, leaves are what we're looking for. We're looking for berries in the spring and summertime. And then we're looking for tubers, generally speaking, in the winter, sometimes into early fall, depends just a little bit. So I want to talk to you guys about three you can be looking for foraging this time of year, even into very early spring. That's going to be burdock, dandelion, and sunchokes. So, I'll start with burdock here. You've probably had these burrs catch on your clothes before. They're kind of the seed pod, the burrs, look like little tiny Velcro hooks. Kind of oblong shaped. And if you get into them, there's no mistaking. And if your deer get into them, they will spread them everywhere. Ask me how I know about that one. But burdock is actually Very, very common anywhere that the soil has gotten compacted and or disturbed. Burdock is doing its work, trying to aerate that soil again. So these can be some pretty large and pretty thick roots. Around here, I find them on edges of disturbed soils, barnyards, fence lines, and sunny openings. Forgive me, but it's been a long day and I'm a little bit tired. So burdock is a biennial. So you actually want to harvest the root the fall of the first year of that plant, or very early in the spring of the second year before it makes its flower stalk. After that, just like I mentioned, the plant is putting its energy elsewhere, and that stalk becomes, or rather the root, once it makes a stalk, that root becomes fibrous and tough, pretty unusable. So burdock has these really large, wavy, and heart-shaped leaves. They have a whitish underside. The leaves on the ones that grow around here are over a foot long when it's, you know, when the plant's really in its prime. And the leaves have a very soft texture, kind of feels like suede. The first year plant will form a low rosette, and in that second year it sends up a tall stalk with the burrs, as I mentioned, and those roots are long. They're kind of a tan, carrot-like color, and can go down 1 to 2 feet. So this is a really good time to use your digging fork or a spud bar to get these out, because they'll tear real easily. So start by working the kind of a wide perimeter and work your way inwards, and try to loosen that soil as much as you can before you pull it, or you're just going to wind up with part of a root. I really like the flavor of burdock root. It's earthy, it's a little bit sweet, it's kind of like a mild carrot, but it's got a kind of a spicy kick to it that I can't quite really give an example of what it is, but it's really worth trying. I think burdock root works really well with other root vegetables like carrot and parsnips. And even, I tell you what, I would really want to try it in is like in a butternut squash soup. I think that would be, especially like as a, like a roasted vegetable topping. That sounds really really good to me. So maybe that's something I need to run past Chef Ken Daniels there. So it's great in soups, combined, especially onions as well. So that's burdock. Be on the lookout for burdock. Very common. And worth the effort of getting out of the ground. So the next one here, dandelion. Everybody knows the dandelion. Lawns, pastures, roadsides, basically everywhere that's not being chemically managed, you're going to find dandelion. And these roots are best in the early spring before flowering, or in the late fall after that first frost is when they really have more flavor. The roots are tan, they're flexible, and they taper down quite a bit. I leave the dandelion in my garden, like where it just comes up in paths and in the beds and stuff. I leave quite a bit of it because my garden's relatively easy to dig, so it's easy for me to get those roots out. And more so, dandelion is used medicinally than as, you know, as technically as a food or a caloric thing. Most commonly known as a coffee substitute, unfortunately without the caffeine. Also used in bitters and tonics and in tea blends. And there's some folk medicine remedy that has dandelion and burdock actually listed, the root listed as liver support and other digestive tonic. Does have some mild diuretic properties, and it appears to be safe for most people, but can be fairly potent. So do your research on that if you want to use dandelion root. I'll pull out a few here and there and just dry them in a paper bag, and we'll use them as usually in teas. That's kind of my go-to for anything medicinal. It's easy enough for me to make stuff into a tea. And then finally here, we'll talk about sunchokes, also known as Jerusalem artichokes or fartichokes, and yes, they will give you the gases for sure. These are readily easy to find along creek banks, field edges, old homestead sites. I found them in thickets. I would find them, I found them all along the creek at the Holler Homestead. I see them alongside, you know, like county roads. They look like very, very tall sunflowers with a very, very small flower relative to typical sunflowers. They are perennial. These tubers, you want to go after these tubers usually by December is when I start thinking about getting into them. If you try to get to them any sooner than that, they're simply not ready. So my preferred way to pull these tubers out is with a either a very wide garden fork or I'll get my broad fork, because you can, you know, plunge those tines in, lift everything up, and those tubers, they're not very far under the soil, so they're definitely one of the easier tubers to gather. My plots that I have here on the farm, I planted on purpose. But when I found them in the wild, they're almost as easy to get out. Like I said, they're very, very close to the soil surface. If you want to look for the these flowers late summer, they're one of the later flowers to bloom in our region. That'll let you kind of eyeball, hey, those are sunchokes. I can go back for those in the wintertime. And these tubers, they form clusters, and you'll be digging them out, and you'll be like, surely I have gotten them all. And I promise you, you have not gotten them all. And these patches really thrive on disturbance. The tubers, I have noticed, I had a couple of areas where I didn't dig them as frequently. I kind of plugged some in as part of a little pasture project, as part of a forage project for the sheep, and they grazed them, but I noticed that by just leaving them in the ground and not digging them out, they kind of, I think they actually crowd themselves out. So in this case, digging into them is actually good for their propagation. So they, in terms of a flavor profile, they are crisp. They have a nutty flavor to me. They're slightly sweet. A lot of people like them raw. I am not crazy about them raw. We've tried them kind of chopped real fine, shredded on salads. But they kind of, they definitely upset my innards if they are raw. If we roast them, if we put them in soups and stews and things like that, they're fine. I have no issue with them. So I think cooking them for those of us with the digestion and all, maybe cooking is going to be the way to go. And low and slow when you're cooking is the key for these as well. We've made them as pretty good hash browns. We have blended them up with new potatoes for basically like a whipped or mashed potato style dish. That was really good. And these really keep well in the soil over the wintertime. I don't really try to dig these out and store them somewhere. The first couple of times I did that, they go mushy. They go limp and soft and mushy. So just leave them in the soil. And what I do to make it easy to find them when it's time to harvest is, after the sunchoke flowers have died back, like after we've had a first frost, I kind of just cut all those stalks to where they're only about a foot or two tall, and then I can just easily either pull those up or, like I said, go in with a garden fork and lift the soil, and it just kind of gives me a visual for finding those later when I've got them kind of growing here and there on various edges around my zone too. So there's some tubers for you to think about. Just want to remind people that just because we're getting into wintertime does not mean that you can't be foraging and you can't be getting out there looking at working on your ID work and that sort of thing. So if I can help you with anything in the realm of understanding your land, understanding what's growing on your land and what that indicates, and how you can use regenerative and permaculture principles to support your own personal resilience, please reach out to me, Carrie Brown, at StrongRootsResources.com, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Good stuff from Carrie. And the one thing I will say about the Jerusalem artichoke that everybody calls for artichokes, if you lacto-ferment them, they cease to be fartichokes. At least their fartichoke power is drastically, and I mean drastically, reduced. And the reason for that is there are certain components to Jerusalem artichokes, inulin being the primary one, that are very difficult for your digestion system, your digestive system, to fully process, and hence it remains undigested until it literally ferments in your lower intestine. Okay, your lower portion of your large intestine extracts additional nutrient from things that you consume, because we are omnivores, and it does it through a fermentation process. So if we lacto-ferment it, those things are already broken down, then they become more digestible, and therefore you do not have to ferment them in your lower intestine before you pass them out the back door, and hence less wind blows out the back door. Just a little addition there for you. Next up, who are we hearing from now? We are hearing from Joel Riles on moving through entryways and doors with your dog and proper training for that.
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you today with another expert counsel question. And today's question is about going in and out of doors with your dog. So John wanted to know, he's having some issues moving with his dog. Should he let the dog go through the doorway first? Should he make the dog wait and go after? And there's a lot of confusion about this in the dog world in terms of, oh, if you let your dog go first, they're establishing dominance over you. So let's jump into this question about whether or not we should let them go before or make them go after, and then how to do the actual drills in the training to get them to do what it is we want. Here's my philosophy on it. I think that you as the handler should decide whether you want the dog to go ahead of you or behind you. And this is going to vary in multiple different situations and scenarios. So if I'm walking onto an airplane and I'm trying to walk down to my seat, I want my dog behind me so they're not constantly trying to go into the different seats. They can walk behind me until we get to where we're supposed to be, and then I guide them into where they are supposed to be at. If I'm walking through a doorway, maybe I want them to go ahead of me and wait on the outside. If the door opens toward me, it's easier to let the dog go first. If the door opens away from me, a lot of times it's easier for me to go first and the dog to come afterwards, right? So there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. You as the handler should be able to make the decision in each individual situation, and then your dog should work with you and be obedient and do what it is you tell them to do. So the other application for this training is if you have problems opening your door and your dog darting out of the doorway, just like racing out of the door as soon as you open it, you may want to do these drills for a couple of months and then start giving some of that freedom back and see if it controls their behavior, right? And they will start to slip back into trying to dart out fast. And I'll have a little thing at the end, a little drill you can do as you start to give them some freedom that can help fix that as well. So here's the first thing we do. I want to teach my dog to walk at my side. Now, you can do this with a regular collar. Depending on how excited and energetic your dog is, you may need to go to something like a prong collar. But basically, we're not looking necessarily for a strict foos here, which is walk at your side. We just want the dog to not pull on their collar, right? So if they're pulling, I bump them back on the collar until they stop pulling. Now again, if you have a really energetic dog, you might need to switch to a prong for this so that there's some level of correction there. But basically the idea is you're not allowed to pull, right? And I want to have some kind of a wait command, whether I can put the dog in a sit and it will sit and wait while I take a couple steps forward, whether I can just say wait and I can step forward and it doesn't move until I tell it to. So you want to get some of those basic things down. We have a lot of information on that on Canine Academy, and you can check those videos out, but it's not hard to teach your dog to sit and wait, just some basic commands. Once you have that, then we start approaching the doorway. And as I get to the doorway where I can reach the handle, I tell the dog, sit, wait. And I open the door, and then I'll give the dog a command. I'll either say, go on, and I'll use my lead to direct them through the doorway, and then I'll follow them out, wait, seats. I'll close the door, and then we'll walk wherever we're going. If I want the dog to go behind me, I will walk up, I will say, seats and wait. I'll open the door, I'll walk through and say, let's go, and bring the dog with me. Put them back in a position, seats, wait, close the door, right? And I can practice these over and over again as I do these drills. Now, again, you can set aside dedicated time to do this every day, or you can just do this every time you take your dog out to use the bathroom, and you're already going out anyway. It's going to add maybe 3 to 5 seconds to your total process, but your dog's obedience and their behavior at a doorway will significantly improve if you start doing these drills. Now, what do we do if our dog breaks? So if I want my dog to wait, and I open the door, and they've already got it in their head that they're going to go. As soon as they see that door open, they're like, go, go, go. That means go. Then what I'm going to do is, it's a very similar drill to what I would do in a crate if they're trying to rush out of the crate too fast. So I start to open the door, but I'm only going to open it about 6 inches. Now, keep in mind, I have a lead on the dog, whether it's a flat or a prong collar, really doesn't matter at this point. I have the lead on the dog. I'm going to have a good grip on the door handle, especially if it's opening out, because if they try to push their way out, I want to have a good grip on it. And I'm only going to open it about 6 inches, maybe even only 4 inches, depending on how hard your dog's trying to push through. And I'm going to tell them to sit. I'm going to tell them to wait. And I'm going to start opening the door. And if they start to dart forward, I'm going to close the door and put them back in their position. Now, if they've already got their head or their snout into the door, I'm going to slam it in the door a little bit. But the goal is not to harm the dog. It's just to give them a little bit of a consequence because I told them to wait and then they tried to rush through the door. So be very cautious of how hard you're. It's more just I'm holding the door and maybe bumping it close an inch so that they're like, oh, that didn't feel good. And they back up. Right? Now, if I open the door in, it's actually a little bit easier because if they try to dart, I just push the door closed again. Right? If it opens out away from me, I'm going to have a good enough grip on that if they're trying to push through, I don't let the doorknob slip out of my hand. Right? And I'm going to put the dog back in their position and I'm going to do it again. Now, here's a couple of nuances to doing that drill. If my normal speed of opening the door, the dog wants to rush out, then I'm going to put them back in their position and I'm going to slow how fast I open the door. I'm going to open it slowly. Good, wait. Open a little bit more. Good, wait. Praise the dog if they're waiting, even if they're excited, right? I might be like, relax. Give them a little bump on the lead. Hey, relax. It's okay. And then we do the drill. And once they get it down where I open it slowly and they're not too amped up, then I'll open it at normal speed. If they break, I'll just give them that correction. And then I want to start doing things where I'll sit at the door and I'll go, wait, and I'll open the door, like kind of sharp and fast, and then good, wait, and then I'll close it. And then I'll open it and I'll close it and I'll open it and I'll close it so that they're desensitizing to the door opening being their trigger for going outside. Right? And each time they don't move, I praise them. If they do move, I correct them and put them back in their position, and I do it again. If they break, say, 2 times as I'm going quicker and quicker, then I'm going to slow it back down again. Give them some praise for waiting, and then I'll speed up how fast I'm opening the door. The speed that you open that door up is going to ramp the dog up a little bit. Right? So I want them to have enough discipline that I can open it fast, and then when I'm doing my normal daily, this is how I open a door normally, they're used to going fast and still being okay, so they should be perfectly fine at my normal paces. Now, if you have a dog that is darting out of the house, there's a couple things you can do. The first thing I do, even when I start to give them freedom, right? So I run these drills for a couple of months, and then it's like, okay, now we're going to start letting the dog just run out and use the bathroom like they were, but I still want them to be controlled going through the doorway. I'm going to do that same drill. I don't have a lead this time, but I've already worked it where on a lead, they're good. Right? And so now there's no lead on the dog and I'm going to go wait and I start to open the door, but I only go 4 to 6 inches. If they try to move before the doors, before I tell them it's okay, I close the door. Right? And I'm going to do that until, okay, they're good. And then I'm going to open it about 6 inches and I'm going to go easy, go on. And you see my dog reacts here to my vocal when I say it like that. He's like, oh, that means something to me. So easy is we're going to go slow this time, right? Or we're going to go slower than normal. Easy, go on. If they rush in the door again, I slam it back in their face. No, get back to your position. Easy, go on. And I might need to put a lead back on them for the easy so that they can feel a little tension if they're going too fast. And then, but as soon as they start to slow it down, good, easy, good, go. Okay, you did great. Go get busy or use the bathroom or whatever your command is for that. And so we start off on a lead. We run those drills, then we can start transitioning to off-lead, but we want to maintain that discipline. And at any point, if your dog starts to get too excited, you can just put the lead back on them, and they'll get it a lot faster the next time around because they already basically understand they were just getting sloppy at it, right? And then you can go right back to off-lead as soon as they have it back under control. So I hope that's been helpful for you guys. If you want more information on training your dog to be well-mannered or to do all kinds of awesome stuff, including up to off-lead obedience, check out Canine Academy. Go over to thesurvivalpodcast.com. That's Jack's website. Click on the Canine Academy banner and you can sign up there. Our basic course is just your basic obedience, 5 basic commands. Our intermediate course is if you want to start getting into some obstacles and training the dogs to cross beams and jump over things. That's what the intermediate course is. And if you want to go all the way up through off-lead obedience, the advanced course is for that. And if you're looking to get a working line puppy, German Shepherd, Dutch Shepherd, or Malinois, or you want a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I really do, on the especially the door part. Yeah, I actually want to speak to something Joel did not speak to there, and that is how many of these dog myths that now exist, primarily due to short-form video content, much of it made by AI, where they show like stock images or stock video reels or even AI video reels of dogs doing things, and then you get this narration voice in the background that says, do you know why your dog licks you? It's because your dog loves you, and they can taste the things they love on you, and stuff like that has created so much mythology around why dogs do what they do. Like, if your dog runs in front of you when you take a walk in the woods, it's because your dog is dominating you. No, it's because your dog moves faster than you. That's why. Because dogs are faster than people. It's that. And they want to know what's up there. And as long as they are in a place where it's okay for them to be off-leash and you trust their recall and they have a track record of being there for you. You know, my Brittany Spaniel, when I was a kid that I trained to hunt pheasants and grouse and squirrels and things like that, yeah, he was always in front of me. You know why? Because that's where the fucking game was, right? Like, this shit pisses me off. And this whole idea that the reason the dog goes through the door first is because he's dominating you is retarded. He or she is excited. You've opened the door. Cool stuff's on the other side of that door. I want to go there. And so the thing is to instill the discipline, because you never know actually if you want the dog to go in first or not, or out first or not. Why is the dog being set out? Are you going to? Like, it all depends. Like, Joel's talking about working the dog on a lead and all. Okay, that's fine, but like, I have a fenced yard. My dogs go out all the time. When they have to take a shit, I open the door and set them out. I don't want the dog feeling the need for me to go out if I want the dog. So it's out, and the dog goes. But what you want is control. Because, you know, I do have a Malinois German Shepherd cross from Joel named Belle. She's a beautiful little dog, but she's very amped up and excited because she's from the protection line, from Joel's lines, right? And so a lot of times I have my older dog, Lucy. She's kind of a husky mix. She's an old lady. She doesn't want to play. And if I put them out at the same time, you know, Belle runs out, turns around, and waits, and she wants to play. And Lucy's like, just leave me alone, right? So, you know, what I'll do is I'll go there and I'll put Belle in a sit, right? Sit, wait. I'll let Lucy go out until she gets off the porch, and then I'll send Belle out. That's just one example. What if I'm using the dog for protection? Do I want to go out to the threat first? Do I want the dog to go out and engage the threat first? See, this is a variable thing. So the problem with these videos and these retards making these videos that are made only to attract attention, only for clickbait, only to make revenue, with no concern for accuracy at all, is even if they were right, it doesn't actually fit every situation. Please be careful with this mythology, especially with dogs. There's a lot of mythology being created by these things, and it's amazing how gullible people are. One of the ones I've started here is a totally unrelated dog one, and we'll go on to the next thing. But I just want to point out how stupid some of this stuff is. So one of the things I've seen start popping up on short video stuff, like on Facebook and Instagram and all, are these videos of all these really pretty young girls that are in the military. And there's some song they play all the time, and there's also that one that they often play with the dog songs. It's basically the Sound of Silence remix, right? Like, and they show these girls dancing and doing all this shit in pretty hair, and they're out moving airplanes around and flying helicopters. None of them are real. They're all AI. People don't dress like that in the fucking military. And you know what? I don't care. That's fine. But, you know, you see one, you're like, this is stupid. 514 comments. What are people saying? Do they know this is fake-ass shit? Like, 1 in 100 does. The vast majority of them, simps. You girls are beautiful. You're simping to AI made by a company in freaking China. A Chinese guy named Huan, or Kang, or whatever, made this video with a bunch of AI-derived bullshit, threw some music on it, and you're simping to the AI avatars. I'm not saying you guys. I'm just saying that's what happens. You need to put these videos about, like, 10 superfoods, or reasons your dog licks its ass, or whatever, you need to put them all in the same category of semi-entertaining bullshit. Please. And then recognize that your friends and family may not. So when your Uncle Tom tells you or your Uncle Bill tells you the reason your dog is sitting first is because she's dominating you, that's probably where they got their information or from someone else who did. Anyway, with that all said, let's go ahead and hear about red light therapy from Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I do health and fitness. My goal is to help you look good naked and become harder to kill. I own CrossFit Garage. We choose CrossFit because it's a pretty damn good hack on this health and fitness thing. Anyway, I have got a question here from Dennis. And Dennis, you are asking a question that I know a lot about, but my wife is the uber expert on. And it's about PEMF and red light therapy for joints and other treatments like cancer and so forth. So the answer is, the harder answer is going to be, I'm going to do a full episode. I'm going to go grab my wife. I'm going to have her sit down beside me. We're going to do a full episode on this because it is fascinating. And it'll be, I think it'll be episode number 240. So she hasn't agreed to it, so I got to go get her to do that. But the answer is yes to your question. All right. I will read your question off. Guys, this is an interesting one. To get full details, go to Food, Fitness, and Finance and look for episode 240. You will find it there when it is published. Question for Andy. Have you used or have knowledge of PEMF pads or red light therapy? Answer is yes. I know PEMF pads are used for easing pain and promoting healing in joints and muscles. Do you think they actually work? Yes. I currently own one for my dog who is an agility competitor and suffers from reoccurring carpal injuries. I have only been using it on him for a few days, so we'll see. So I'm going to pause right there and say dogs and animals are great when you do these things because they don't really have the placebo effect. So you're going to see if it does or doesn't work. We've done a thing for our dog using photo patches, but I'll get to that later. So I have specific usage on those two devices on humans, but not dogs, though, I've used the patches and I'll talk about it. On to red light therapy. My wife is interested in them to promote healing in her throat after undergoing radiation and chemotherapy for throat cancer. Do you have any experience or knowledge on these two devices? The answer is yes. Okay, so let me give you the yes, go ahead and try these things. I have found in my own life they work. My son, if you've heard the story, he basically got hit with a Crohn's diagnosis. He came back from college. He went to college at 170 pounds. He came home from college his sophomore year at 135 pounds and then proceeded through the summer to drop down to 117. We tried lots of stuff. We weren't 100% sure what it was. Could it have been specifically an autoimmune issue? Could it have been viruses and parasites and so forth? The answer is, I don't really know. We used the Lion diet as a part of the solution. The other big part was my wife had this thing called a Beamer mat, B-E-M-M-E-R, and it is expensive, and you have to know a rep to get this thing, and we put him on it, and myself, and other people, other family members, there's six of us, on it to try various things. So yes, the answer is I have experience, and I have seen with my own eyes it work on Evan. I don't claim to feel any different, but my wife and one of my daughters says yes, so in my house, three people who tried it say yes. The one guy, me, who tried it says, not so much. I will admit to being a scientific anomaly. There are many things that don't work on me. For example, caffeine does not wire me. I can go to sleep right after drinking a whole entire pot of coffee. All right, real quick. The PEMF is Pulsed Electromagnetic Field Therapy. And yes, if you go out there and look, you're going to see the evidence that this stuff works for people, though not everybody's body works exact same. So yes, try it, especially because you have specific concerns. One of my philosophies is if you have money, if you have a problem that money can solve, then it's not a problem. So these things can get expensive, but they can work. I'll make sure to give Jack some Amazon links so you can look at some of the pads to purchase for yourself if you don't already have the right ones. Basically, it sends a low-frequency electromagnetic pulse into the tissues in the joints, so you're getting a stimulation that is sort of like being out in the sun, so you could try just using the sun, which is free, but these things are very focused, and you can, especially like on that Beamer mat, you can attune it to a different setting to get different results. It's kind of a frequency-based thing, which, man, I get it. If you are the granola type of person with health, then you're going to love this. If you're the type of person that says, no, holistic is just a bunch of voodoo witch doctors, then it's not going to make a lot of sense. Okay, on to the red light therapy. Specifically for joint recovery, yes. For cancer stuff, man, that's a big, I don't know. I haven't tried that. My wife is much more into the whole helping people fix weird things. She's been doing it to our family our whole lives. We are a family that doesn't have primary doctors. We don't have a pediatrician. They didn't get really any shots of any type. We sort of did it all natural, and everyone except for Evan is pretty much okay. Actually, Evan's fine now. Thank you for asking. And yeah, so this stuff has a place and it works. But again, I am that anomaly. Most of this does not work on me. So the red light therapy uses near-infrared light and red light wavelengths to penetrate the skin and kind of like inject into the mitochondria, the healing, and so forth. So again, does it work? I have seen it legitimately with my own eyes. Am I a doctor? No, but I have seen it. But I also saw it not work on me. So I would throw it on this. Most of the time, these amplify recovery and are not miracle cures. Evan may be a one-off. I don't know. My wife and daughter both say they've got a lot more recovery out of it. I don't know if it fixed anything on them, but the recovery is for sure. I would also lean into the five pillars of health and fitness, how you eat, sleep, move, think, and connect. But, of course, a dog doesn't know any of that. I would just say, you know, take the dog out more and give it more pets. But on joint specific for dog, there's other things you could do. For example, you can give your dog some kefir. I would get the plain unflavored, and I've seen that work to help promote healing in dogs, so give that a try. Turmeric and coumarin you can try, but I would assume the dog's issues are going to be from overuse, and much like a human, the way you wouldn't not want to use those joints, that would be a bad thing to say, don't use it, and then go explode and do things with it. Instead, train it so you can do like wobble boards and you know, other easier motions, like put them in a pool and let them swim around so you get some movement without the impact. I'm sure you've dialed in the nutrition and probably even have like soft beds for them to lay on or pads and such. A big thing is if you haven't adjusted the food, look at that. It may be something like you start cooking for your dog, and human food is way better than dog food. Yep, maybe go shoot a deer and give him all those good bits. All right, guys. Hey, this is Andy McCann. Sorry I went a bit long on here, Jack. And I will do a full episode on this topic with Verity, my wife, who is an expert in this stuff, at least an expert in our little Woodstock area. Again, there'll be some links for you to find some stuff on Amazon. Y'all take care. Oh, and if you need to hit me directly, andy@crossfitgarage.com, and I will connect you to my wife if you just want to go that route.
Good stuff from Andy. As I said, my wife is actually using red light therapy right now. The jury would still be out on that. It's a very new thing, and I will make sure that she gets to listen to this as well. And my answer to it at this point is I don't know. And it's one of those things that I'm immediately skeptical of. I think it was Henry Ford that said skepticism is the balance wheel of the world, and that we should be skeptical of new things. You can't believe it just because it's alternative. But the little bit I've looked at it, it seems to have some definite legitimacy and some really positive feedback. So we'll see long term, and I'll update you on my opinion of it in the future. Next up, we have a segment by Mike Melito on shotguns for deer hunting.
Hey, TSP. Jack asked for segments. Didn't get any questions from you guys this week, so make sure you're sending in your questions for the expert counsel, myself or otherwise. I'm not sure if Jack is going to do another expert counsel before the New Year's. I know he likes to take time off. Good for him. I thought I'd do one on hunting deer with a shotgun. For a few reasons, this is a survival podcast. I do believe that Jack shares this opinion because I've listened to him for a lot of years. Some of my favorite ones are his old Jetta day's firearms topics podcast. He's done many on the shotgun, and I think he would agree that the shotgun is the most versatile small arm someone can have. It is great for defense. It is great, unrivaled, for the variety of putting food on the table. I like it for both of these things. I'm going to talk about deer hunting with the shotgun today because it seems like in the gun tube glitterati culture that you need several $1,000 custom rifle, a gigantic optic, a laser rangefinder, a bipod, a tripod, a ballistic app, probably with all that gear a $10,000 quad or side-by-side to ride around on to shoot a deer. And that's just not true. I grew up a poor boy in the South, and I don't mean that like ironically. I mean I was actually very poor. The son of an unwed single teenage mother. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm very blessed for the childhood that I had. One of the things I had was a couple of uncles. One of those, I don't know how he got it, trade deal or something, I don't know. I don't remember him ever being a shooter. One of those uncles had a bolt-action 410 Mossberg shotgun. Bottom of the barrel, cheap, beat up even when I got it, shotguns. I don't think it worked when he got it. He gave it to my other uncle, who was a hunter, for me, who fixed it up for me to use. And kind of my ideal way to spend my youth was out in the woods running around putting meat on the table with a shotgun. Small game, upland game birds, and deer. I hunted deer with that 410 shotgun and later on graduated to a single shot 20 gauge. And I took more deer than I can remember with that. I thought I remembered my first deer and I went back home and talked to some relatives and like, oh no, you shot deer before that. I shot a lot of deer with those guns. You still can. So if you're going to be like the one gun kind of guy into survival, being prepared, I assume you are listening to this podcast, the shotgun is great for all those things. It also works good for deer. You're not going to have the range of a rifle. But many, many deer, even with those fancy rifles, are shot inside the range a shotgun is good for. Let's start out with buckshot. Aptly named, I have shot deer and bear with buckshot, double-aught, number four, probably some triple-aught in there. Use it at ethical ranges. I would say a good thing to do for this is the old pie plate or the old paper plate. If you're using double-aught buck, traditional load, 9 pellets, use it at a distance you can consistently, in my opinion, get at least 4 of those 9 pellets on that circle. Now, many of the other pellets will hit the deer. 4 of those pellets in that vital zone of double-aught buck is enough. The standard load for number 4 buck is 27 pellets. I prefer number 4 buck. And I've used it on deer, I've used it on bear. I prefer number 4 buck. And a magnum load of that is going to have 41 pellets. That's a lot of pellets. I think about a dozen pellets of those in the vital zone, plus a bunch of other ones in the other areas of the deer, is plenty ethical enough. To determine what that is for your shotgun, shotguns are very individual. And a little caveat here, oaks, which I'm just briefly going to gloss over, they don't always behave the same way with buckshot as they do with birdshot. You may actually get a better pattern with a more open choke with bigger buckshot. One of the reasons I like number 4 tends to pattern more like traditional shot. You may end up with a longer ethical shot distance with number 4. There are other buckshots, but those are two pretty common ones. Now, slugs. I'm not talking about a specialty shotgun with a rifle barrel. Those are great, and if you live in an area where you can only hunt with a shotgun and that's your jam, there's nothing wrong with that. You know what you're doing, probably. Just a regular old smoothbore shotgun. I don't like an old shotgun with just a bead, although you could get it done if you're very good. Just not much to a line there. A vent rib with a couple of beads, or my preferred, a shotgun smoothbore with rifled sights, either open sights or ghost ring sights. But you can get some impressive distances with a shotgun slug. The most common one in America is a Foster rifled slug. Just like you would do with a rifle, pattern sight in your shotgun with the slugs. Don't just pick up your shotgun and pick up whatever's the cheapest, you know, box of slugs at Walmart. Expect them to shoot where you're aiming because you really, really want it to. That's not how that works. Get your shotgun, get your slugs. Generally, these kind of slugs shoot best out of an improved cylinder choke. Designed to be used through pretty much any choke. I wouldn't shoot a bunch of them through a full choke, but generally they shoot best through an improved cylinder, which is one of my preferred chokes anyway. But you do your own patterning and shooting. Different brands, different weights. Very ordinary one for a 12 gauge, the 1 ounce slug, which is like 437 grains, give or take, at around 1600 feet a second. That's not even a magnum. That's a regular slug. That is a powerhouse. I dropped my elk last year with that type of setup. Smoothbore shotgun, rifled sights, 1 ounce rifled Foster slug. There are other slugs that are less common, like a Bernecki slug. I actually think that's a better design, although they're less common here in the U.S. But distance you can get that slug in, that going back to that pie plate, that's your ethical distance. You would be surprised if you practice how long a distance that is. 125, 150 yards with just smoothbore shotgun is not uncommon. Again, assuming you have sights and assuming that you are actually going to find a slug that shoots point of aim, point of impact, where you're aiming. But if you have that shotgun and you want to put meat on the table for your family, get out with what you have. Get out with that shotgun if that's all you have. If you want to get started into hunting, spending time in the woods, learning field craft, learning how to walk quietly, be patient, read the wind, all these are more important than the actual gun in your hands. I think in the world of gear nerdism and all the fancy rifles and fancy stuff, which I also like, we lose sight of the fact that you can go out with a $100, $150, maybe with inflation, single shot, break open shotgun and hunt deer and do it successfully. Or, you know, splurge and go $200 on a Maverick 88 pump shotgun. Or a good used shotgun you find for a deal at a gun store or gun show. And do very well in hunting, and even hunting deer. Anyway, with that, guys, hopefully you enjoyed this. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP. And have a blessed day.
Well, he's absolutely correct that I consider the shotgun the most versatile small arm on the planet. And always imaginable. If you have something that you can kill a bear with or kill an elk with and then turn around, you change ammo, obviously, but turn around, use the exact same weapon without changing anything about the weapon itself other than the ammunition, and knock a quail or a dove out of the air or a squirrel out of a tree and not blow the shit out of it, it is very difficult to argue with that versatility. And then turn around and throw that number four buck in it and clear a room or clear a house and know that when a two-legged rat catches that in the chest, it's done instantly. Yeah, it's about as versatile as things get. The Foster slug, I was brought up taught they're just not accurate. Now, I don't know exactly what the ammo was like, let's say, in the 50s when my dad was a kid. But I remember him telling me this, and I had an 870 shotgun. It was my first, like, big-time, like, adult gun, an 870 that I got when I was 14 years old. And I went out and picked up a couple boxes of just plain old Foster 12-gauge slugs. And by the way, it was an improved cylinder. I'm totally with Mike on that, too. The best all-around choke on a shotgun is an improved cylinder. If you can't do 90% of the things you want to do with an improved cylinder, changing the choke won't help you. Long shots on turkeys on the ground, trying to hit them in the head, knocking geese out of the air at distance in the wind, things like that, that's where you want it more constriction and what have you. But improved cylinder, all around, just phenomenal. Across the gauges, by the way, I'll say that too. But that's what I had. It was long before every shotgun came with choke tubes in it. And in fact, choke tubes were a very new thing all the way back then. In the olden days, back in 1986 or 5 or whatever it was. I picked these up and I set a bottle on a stump about 25 yards away. And this is not sights, just a flat rib and a bead. Put that bead in the center of that bottle, squeezed off like I was shooting a rifle, and the bottle exploded into obliteration. Moved back to 50 yards, again, the bottle exploded into oblivion. Because when you hit a bottle with a 75 caliber slug, it does. When guy my dad told me, bullshit, he came out, takes the gun, loads a shell in it, blows up another bottle and goes, well, son of a bitch. Now, I never shot those things over 100 yards. I never even thought about it. But I'm going to say that maybe a couple deer ended up in the freezer at times when deers aren't supposed to end up in freezers, because we also grew up poor. And we hunted for food. And there was a saying about certain people. It wasn't necessarily meant to be taken literally. It was just an understanding of what it meant. And that was, that boy's smokehouse runs in June. And that simply meant you were looking at another person like you that occasionally might bend the law a little bit, because it was more important that the family eat well than we did what the state said we were supposed to do. Right, if that shocks you, maybe you don't know what I mean when I said I am the son of a bootleg coal miner. Because that's a little bit more of a high crime and misdemeanor than maybe taking a deer out of season here and there. Anyway, I don't do that anymore. Of course, we can also shoot 5 deer a year, and that's plenty enough for anybody. Back in the days I'm talking about, it was a relatively short season if you weren't an archery hunter, which I was, and you were allowed 1 deer a year. So that we needed to feed ourselves, and occasionally that meant going the extra mile. All right, now, before I give you my segment today, actually, I got 2 more segments today. Maybe I messed up in my numbering here. We had a thing called Cloudflare outage recently, and I want to go ahead and get that on because it's been a while already since it happened. But there were a lot of questions about how does a service like Cloudflare end up shutting down like half the dadgone internet? And I thought it was a really interesting answer from Jesse Markowitz. So I got him, and then I got one more before I come back, and I'll be updating my show notes while we listen to Jesse here.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question from Paul. Paul asks, what is Cloudflare, and why did it destroy the entire internet today? By the time you hear this on the Survival Podcast, the outage Paul is talking about is probably a few weeks behind us. But the incident is worth walking through because it's a perfect example of how the modern internet actually works and why so many things seem to fail at the same time when one major piece of the system breaks. Let's start with what Cloudflare actually is. Cloudflare is a major web infrastructure company that sits between you, the user, and the website you want to visit. When you type a web address into your browser, you're usually not talking directly to the website server. Instead, your traffic goes through a series of hops, your device to your router or modem, your ISP, and very often to Cloudflare or a similar company before finally reaching the actual server hosting the site. Cloudflare caches copies of website data so pages load faster, and it filters out malicious traffic, everything from botnets to denial of service attempts. Depending on the estimate you look at, Cloudflare sits in front of roughly 1/5 of all websites. And not just social media. This includes things like ChatGPT, X, Twitter, Shopify, crypto exchanges, banking, fintech apps, authentication systems, logistics, and even some government services. So when Cloudflare has a major outage, all of the sites behind it break at the same time. Your computer might be fine, the website server might be fine, but the path between the two is broken. And that path is increasingly controlled by just a handful of companies. On November 18th, when Paul sent in his question, Cloudflare experienced one of those outages. They reported an unusual spike in traffic that overwhelmed parts of their global routing system. When that happens, their edge servers start throwing errors, and entire regions can go dark for a while. And because Cloudflare sits in front of so many sites, it looks like the entire internet is down. Cloudflare is not the only company that provides this sort of front layer. Other big players include Akamai, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. Collectively, these content delivery networks, CDNs, probably sit in front of about half of all websites. Some very large companies like Apple, Microsoft, and Netflix run their own CDNs in-house. And of course, plenty of smaller websites still serve traffic directly from a single server with no CDN at all. But this is where understanding the chain really matters. If you can't get to your favorite website, it might not be the website itself that's broken. It might be one of these middle layers. So how do you figure out where the problem actually is? Here's a few simple checks. First, try loading a different website. If that one loads fine, the issue is probably isolated to the website you wanted or the CDN in front of it. You can also check sites like downdetector.com or isitdownrightnow.com to see whether other people are reporting trouble with the same service. If no websites are loading, then the issue is likely your device, your local network, or your ISP. Try a second device. You can also try a different browser. I normally use Brave, but sometimes switching to Chrome or Edge quickly tells me whether it's a browser issue. Another easy test. Switch from your home or office Wi-Fi to your phone's cellular data. If the site loads on cellular but not Wi-Fi, that isolates the problem to the local network or ISP. If you're using a VPN, try turning it off. VPN exit nodes get blocked, filtered, or misrouted often enough that this is an easy fix. If things still aren't working, go ahead and restart your device or your router. That clears caches and stale entries that can sometimes cause weird behavior. One advantage of running your own server on your own home network, like with Start9, is that you remove all of those external dependencies. The global internet could be having a horrible day. ISPs, CDNs could all be melting down, and it doesn't matter to you at all. As long as your home network is up, you can still reach your self-hosted services locally. Of course, if you're trying to access them remotely, you're not at home, then you're once again dependent on the internet infrastructure in front of you. Understanding these layers can help you troubleshoot problems more effectively and make better decisions about which services you rely on. And if you're exploring self-hosting, understanding this can help you design systems that stay available even when some of those big tech internet guys have outages. That's it for today. If you've got a question about Bitcoin, privacy, self-hosting, other tech topics, please send them in to Jack for the next Expert Counsel show.
Well, I'm going to have to say that I knew most of that, but I didn't know about a website called downrightnow.com. I've usually just, you know, gone to Google or Brave Search or something like that, put is so-and-so site down, and usually if it's a bigger site, like a Facebook or an X or something, it'll tell you, that you'll find search results telling you what's going on. That's kind of a cool thing to know, especially when you're dealing with smaller sites like maybe your own. You can't get to your website, and you're wondering, is your site down, or do you have a problem from your access point? So that's a good little thing to know there, because that does occasionally happen. Anyway, let's talk about, I got thrown off. I think I left one of those out of the show, one of the segments out of the show notes, and I just made the update because before my segment, we have Antonio Gatto talking to us about how to find a good handyman, and then I'll come back with my segment.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I trust that all of you had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend with your family and friends, and I'm very happy to be back to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvement work and real estate. So let's get started today. Today's question comes in from Matthew. Matthew writes in, "Hello, Antonio. How do I find a good handyman who will do good work and not overcharge me? I know you have a lot of knowledge about building and rehabbing homes, and I have a lot of projects I need to do around the house that are really over my level of expertise, such as electrical work, work that needs to look pretty, plumbing work, etc. Can you give me good ways to look for a handyman who is competent and not charging ridiculous prices? I don't mind paying for value, and I don't want to be cheap, but I want to make sure I'm being frugal at the same time. Any information you would be able to provide would be of great help. Thank you for your time. Sincerely, Matthew." Well, Matthew, that is a fantastic question, and I would like to label that as the million-dollar question because, unfortunately, so many homeowners today go through that problem when a repair needs done or they're looking to take on a very large home improvement project, and that is, who do I call and who do I trust? So I put together for you a list of things that you should do and also a list of things that you should not do while you're conducting your search for a reliable and reputable GC. So let's talk about the things that you should not do first. Number one, right out of the gate, I always advise people, avoid the large national companies. These are your big box stores. These are your Lowe's home improvement stores. These are your Home Depots. Now, why, you may ask? Well, for two main reasons. Number one are the inflated prices, and number two, the simple fact that all of the work that comes out of those retailers are all subcontracted work. Now, what does this mean for you as a homeowner? What this means is you have no idea who is going to be showing up to the house to do the work. You have no idea their background. You have no idea what their designations are, and you have no idea what their credentials are. And with that being said, there is also an element there that is lacking, and that is the element of the accountability and the integrity. if they should do shoddy work, if they should do improper installations, guess what? Their reputation is not on the line. Lowe's and Home Depot's reputation is on the line. There's a very big difference between that and having a local contractor that makes his living in the community where his reputation is very valuable and very prudent for his career moving forward. So this is definitely something that you want to always take into consideration. Secondly, you want to avoid anybody that advertises on the radio or the TV commercials. These are usually very typical. We will give you $1,500 off if you sign today. They usually have unethical business practices. They overcharge and they are very difficult to get a hold of during and after the transactions. And if you look at most of their reviews, you will find that the majority of them are negative. They do not have a very solid track record. And for all the reasons that I just stated, I always suggest that people stay away from anybody that advertises in that area. And you also want to avoid the people that walk around and knock on your door and leave flyers at your door. Now, there's a reason for this. The majority of those companies that do that, generally speaking, they are out of business within a couple years. And there's a reason for this. What they do is they accumulate just enough work to get them through that period. They offer warranties that they know they're not going to honor because they already know that the business is going to shut down and you get stuck holding the bag 3 and 4 and 5 years later when something goes wrong and that company is no longer in business. This is a regular occurrence all across the United States and more people need to be aware of this, which is why you definitely want to deal with somebody local that has a solid track record and somebody that has been in business for quite a while and has a very good reputation. These companies generally do not offer that. Now, the last thing that I want to mention here as far as things that you should not do is very important, and everybody should listen to this. When a contractor comes to your house, if he is not able to give you a price right up front, if he throws at you, well, I charge by the hour and I don't know how much this is going to be, that is not a contractor that you want to deal with. That is such a nebulous approach. It is very ambiguous. It's open to so many different interpretations. If you are a upstanding, respected contractor, you should be able to walk into a house for a repair, look to see what needs done, know how much materials you have, and know how much time it's going to take you, and give the customer a price right on the spot. If not on the spot, at least email them an estimate so they can make a decision. That is what you want. Do not take on any contractor that cannot give you a price up front. That can create a lot of headaches. It can create a lot of discrepancies, and those outcomes are generally never very positive. Now, let's talk about things that you should do when you are looking for a contractor. Number one, the first thing that I always suggest to people is start with your friends, family, and neighbors. Generally, these are people that had a firsthand experience or they wouldn't be giving you a recommendation. You can ask questions such as, hey, were you happy with the work? Was this company responsible? Did they return all the calls? Would you use them again? Was there anything that you were not happy with? Don't be afraid to ask these questions because these people should be more than happy to answer those for you. And generally, they're going to be very honest because you know these people, whether it's your neighbors, whether it's your friend, whether it's an extended family member. And secondly, another piece of advice that I want to give to everybody, and this surpasses any Google search, and that is to get onto your local Facebook group page for your community and also get onto the Nextdoor app. And here's why. Generally, when you are a member of any of those groups, you know multiple people in that community. And if there is a request for a recommendation for HVAC, for a roofer, for an electrician, for a plumber, there is a very good chance that you will know the person that is making that recommendation and they dealt with them one-on-one and they have a good firsthand experience. That, to me, is way more credible than a Google review that could have been written by anybody throughout the United States. It could be a friend, it could be a relative, and that, unfortunately, does happen quite a bit. So when you stay local, there's a sense of community and there's a sense of trust and there's a sense of accountability that goes along with that, too, coming from the contractor side, because his reputation is very important to survive. And that leads me to my next part in this, and that is always stay local if you can. And here is why. Because local general contractors usually are much more ethical because their reputation is on the line. If they do shoddy work, if they do not honor warranties, their business goes south. And what happens when they go south? They go out of business. they usually operate from a much higher integrity and a much higher standard that you don't get from the big retailers, from the big box stores. So that's why I'm such an advocate for trying to stay local if you can. And finally, and most importantly too, make sure that they are licensed and insured. If you do all of this, that is all of the due diligence that you can do within a reasonable manner. I hope this helps you, Matt. If you have any more questions, please feel free to reach out anytime. Jack, keep the questions coming to me. I will be more than happy to answer them for our amazing audience. Everybody stay safe, have fun, and never stop learning. Have a great rest of the day.
So I'll throw a couple things in on this. One, I agree with the issue with like a Home Depot or Lowe's installer. The one thing you have there, though, is that there is accountability back to Lowe's or Home Depot or other box stores where if something isn't right, they will make it right, usually by sending back the person that screwed it up in the first place. Or if that fails, they'll get someone else to take care of it. Where if you hire someone and you do not know them and they do not have a track record and they're just a handyman type of thing, they may just leave you hanging dry. Okay, that is the case. The other side of this, though, is when you're looking for a handyman, I think it depends on how much work we're talking about. You start getting like general contractor level work and stuff like that, where you're doing like big full-on remodels or something, it's a little bit different. But the general concept of like a handyman is somebody that you bring in to do the things that you don't have the time to or you don't know how to do. That are, you know, kind of mid-level projects or something. Like, here's an example. I'm not real good at miter cuts and measurements. It's something I can do, but I don't like to do it. And so I'm not real great at trim work. So I've done things like do the flooring work myself and hire a handyman to come in and do the base floor trim, the trim around the doors, and maybe crown molding for me. Like that is an example. Or I have a project outside. It's something I'm capable of doing, like gutters for a water catch system off my back shop. I don't want to spend time on a ladder. I don't have, so I'll get somebody to do that. And we've had a lot of different things done by handymen, whether it be some flooring work when I didn't want to do that at all. We had a really great handyman when I lived up in Pennsylvania at the house we had up there. And that's not when I was growing up. That's when I worked there for about 3-year period. And he did wonderful work for us with things like we had a dog that freaked out during fireworks while we weren't home and tore siding off around this big giant double sliding glass door to our back deck. And none of the siding companies wanted to fix it for us. And he looked at it and goes, I can fix that. And he basically just trimmed it all off and framed it with 2x6s and painted it to match. And it looked like it was designed that way. So that was the kind of person I'm talking about here when I say this. When you're looking for somebody like that, especially you're new to an area or you've given up on the person you used to use or they retired or something, what it makes a lot of sense to do is take something that maybe you would be willing to do, that you do know how to do. That means if it's not done right, you can fix it. And when you're giving somebody a shot, give them that job first. It doesn't cost a lot of money. You're not out much if there's a problem. You get a look at them. And I'm looking at things like, how do they conduct themselves when they're there? Not just the quality of the work. Like, how do they conduct themselves when they're on my property? When they tell me they're coming at 10 o'clock, do they show up at 10 o'clock? If something happens and they can't show up at 10 o'clock, do they text me or call me and say, hey, man, I know I told you I'd be there at 10, but, right? When you have somebody that shows up, conducts themselves properly, and does good work, they're probably worth taking a bigger risk on. So a lot of times when I'm looking for a new handyman, what I'll do is give them something, even something I could do, to like a job interview. Because if they do that well, then they're probably going to take something that's more money involved, a little bit more seriously, and they're going to do it even better. Where if they half-ass the easy thing, I don't want them coming back. Hope that helps. Anyway, let's go ahead now and talk about one of my favorite subjects, guns. Like I said, somebody emailed me, and they wanted to know my opinion of the new Marlin Trapper in 10mm semi-auto. Now, let me just say, the Marlin Trapper is a beautiful gun, no matter the caliber you selected it in. And there's a large number of calibers available, all the way up to like 45-70 and down to like 357 Magnum, okay? It is stainless steel. It's a dark laminate stock. It looks good. It probably, the action is probably like butter on it. And if you ever get a Marlin lever gun, even a used one that's not like butter, and you send it to Marlin, they will apologize that it's not like butter and they will make it like butter. I'm telling you, there's no need for you, if you buy a used Marlin for such a small amount of money for a tune-up, you can send it into Marlin and they will make it beautiful. Okay, they will fall over themselves to make it beautiful for you. But the newer ones pretty much come in the box with an action that works like butter. So if the person that asked this question, if you want this gun, buy it. Despite everything I'm about to say, if you just want it, you like the 10mm and you like the 16-inch barreled lever platform and you like the stainless and you like all the things about it and you're willing to come out of pocket, you know, the MSRP on this thing is about $1,500, almost $1,600 actually, but street price you're in the $1,300 range. And if you're willing to pay $1,300 for a admittedly beautiful, well-built, American-made, brand-new gun, stainless steel in 10mm, go ahead and do it. Now, here's the other side. Okay, so, like I said in the beginning of the show when I was doing my intro, I love the 10mm for what it is. I love lever guns for what they are. And in general, I love pistol caliber carbines. One of my first really big episodes was all about pistol caliber carbines, when nowhere near what is available today was available all the way back in 2008. That was one of the first big episodes that people just loved, okay? But it doesn't mean I love them all put together. So when Smith & Wesson comes out with a semi-auto carbine and releases it in 9mm and 40 Smith, my first question is, when 10mm, Smith & Wesson? Why would you do this? Like, literally, you could have built the same gun and changed out a few things internally, and it would have done all those things out of the gate. I don't know why you wouldn't do this. But let's talk about why I feel that way. The 10mm is a semi-automatic cartridge. It is designed to function in semi-automatic weapons. That is its purpose. When it was designed, its designers were not like, we want to build something that'll work in a lever gun, or we want to build something that'll work in a carbine. It was developed for the FBI. It was designed to outperform the 9mm, which it does in spades. And that's what it was designed to do. It was designed to work in a duty-sized semi-auto handgun, which it does beautifully. Turned out the FBI had already started hiring people that the FBI probably shouldn't hire. In other words, limp-wristed people who can't handle the recoil and the added size of the grips of the 10mm. So that's where the 40 Smith came from. All the 40 Smith is the 38 Special to the 357 Magnum. Right, so the 40 Smith is a cut down 10mm. That's all it is. That lets the grip be a little bit more conventional size, more like the size of 9mm, and puts the recoil into the 9mm range, and still gives a ballistic advantage to knock down power over the 9mm. So that was the compromise made. That left the 10mm kind of without a home until people realized, like, this is like a semi-auto round that is an excellent, like, deer-sized game, even up to the size of, like, typical black bear, boar, hunting weapon. And then when Glock started making guns in it, it kind of really had a huge resurgence, and then we had 1911 frames that worked with it, and, like, it became a thing. And so there are a lot of people, if they're not looking for a compact concealed carry gun, if they're looking for like a duty carry or they open carry or whatever, this is a fantastic sidearm. It is a fantastic sidearm for hunters because it's more than capable of taking down things like deer, okay? So it's great. And out of a handgun, it is far superior to something like the 357 Magnum or the 357 SIG. Far superior. By a couple hundred feet per second and a significant amount of energy when you're talking 4-6-inch barrels. So it's an upgrade there. But it's made to cycle well in semi-autos. That's what it does. When we put it in a carbine, there was no intention in its design that it would perform well, but it does. It is a significant bump up when you go to a 16-inch barrel like the Marlin Trapper. And it hits like a sledgehammer. hits really hard. It hits about the same as the 357 Magnum. In fact, the 357 Magnum has about 100 to 150 foot per second muzzle velocity advantage over it. So how does that happen? Well, the 357 Magnum case has a fair amount of capacity to it. It doesn't get what it gets all from pressure, which is how we did it with the 10 millimeter. Like, we built the gun and the round to be a very high pressure round, where the 357 is just more high pressure than the 38 Special, a little bit longer case. What that means is that capacity was built at a different time, right? The 357 Magnum is a product of Elmer Keith's work in the 1930s, okay? So it has a fairly significantly long case, which means we can put a lot of slow-burning powder in it in a hot load, and that slow-burning powder capacity in a 16-inch barrel where all the powder can burn takes away the advantage and actually hands it back to the 357. Translation, in a lever-action 16-inch barreled carbine, the 357 and the 10 millimeter are very, very close, with a slight advantage going to the 357. So, what does that mean for the 44 Magnum? It means it's not even in the same league. A 44 Magnum out of a 16-inch barrel is a sledgehammer and a half. It is, again, they're not even close. The advantage of the 44 over the 10 millimeter in a carbine is the same as the advantage of a 44 over a 357. You might want the 357, but you're not going to say that it's more powerful. You're not even going to go there, right? That's where we're at. So what does all that add up to for me? Lever action guns were made to shoot straight-walled rimmed cartridges. That's what they're designed to do. I bet you the 10 millimeter in this performs flawlessly, but why would I downgrade my ballistic performance without any real compatibility to a sidearm? Because the compatibility with a sidearm is really going to be a magazine compatibility. Now, I'll say this. If you love the 10mm and you have 10mm and you're well invested in the 10mm and you just like it and you want to buy a lever gun and you have the funds and you want to buy this, go do it. But if I'm looking to buy this gun, I'm probably thinking about the total utility of the weapon for the rest of my life. Ammo availability, the ease of reloading, all of it goes to the 44 and the 357 both. So I'm either going to go for added power or greater availability, and that you're going to be able to shoot 38 specials in your 357 if you go with the 357. So either, and you have way more bullet flexibility as well. Hard casts, heavy-ass bullets, light-ass bullets, mouse loads, heavy loads, out of either of them, then the 40 or the 10 millimeter will give you, right? So I just wouldn't go there. Where I like the 10 millimeter in a carbine is if you have a sidearm with magazine compatibility to a semi-auto carbine, and both of those are in 10 millimeter. I love that. And that's where I'm getting a semi-auto that's giving me the ballistics performance of the 357 Magnum. I love that. I love that. And that's what a 10mm pistol carbine does, is it equals that level of performance. And I am not aware of any really great semi-autos that are available in either the 357 or the 44. There used to be one. There used to be one. And it was absolutely fantastic, and it was called the Deerfield Carbine, made by Ruger. And if you can find, and they were made in 44 Magnum with a rotary magazine that fit flush to the weapon, that carried like a lever gun, nice and short and springy, ring sights instead of your open buckhorns, was designed to be scoped as well. Ruger should bring that gun back. That was one of the finest made semi-autos for hunting, busting around in the bush ever. But they don't make it anymore. So if I'm looking for a semi-auto to hunt with in a carbine, or I'm looking to match something up to like a carry gun or a duty gun full-size frame, then things like the Ruger, etc., that will do that for me, I'm very interested in that. When it comes to a lever gun, this is a cowboy gun made to look like a modern gun, designed to shoot the type of rounds, and it just, to me, makes more sense. But I'm back to, if you want it, go get it. But if you ask so that I would say, yeah, definitely do it, no, I just think, and I'm going to also say this. If you want to invest in something really well made and beautiful, the Trappers are that. The Trapper Model 1894s are that. And again, they're available in a large diversification of cartridges. However, if you just want a good lever action with a 16-inch barrel, there's a lot of used Marlins and Rossies even out there. And a trip to a gun show, you can probably pick one up for between $500 and $700. And then you can probably buy all the shit you need, including, you know, a variety of bullets and primers and several cans of powder, plus the presses and the dies for either .357 or .44 Magnum with the spread and the money that you'll save. And so to me, just from a value standpoint, I don't really feel like you get that much money value out of these newer levers. And I also need to say something. Ruger's a fine company, but everything I said about Marlin, I don't actually know if that's true anymore. I haven't sent a gun to Marlin in a very long time, so I don't remember when, but I believe Ruger actually owns Marlin now, and I don't know if they have the same policy on service. I do know that I picked up a 44 Magnum lever action Marlin back in the 90s, and it just kind of stuck as it was feeding rounds out of the gate. And when I got it back from Marlin, it was like I sent it to a custom shop. It was absolutely astounding how beautiful the work was that they did. Anyway, with that, we have wrapped up another episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you take issue with my thoughts on the 10mm in a semi-auto, or I'm sorry, in a lever gun, that's okay. Again, I think this is a very personal decision. If you take issue with anything else I had to say, that's also cool. Remember, this show is marketed as and delivered as one man's opinion. My goal is always to make you think, not to make you agree with me. And I think we would do better if more people in the world today would take that stance. Know why you believe, know what you believe what you want, but know why you believe what you believe. I will sign off now, and I won't be back until Monday. We'll have another full week next week. Should be a lot of cool stuff, and I'll let you know, like, I just actually did something I'm really, really excited about. But it will not happen until January when we come back after the vacation. And that is, I have now booked as an interview the CEO of Pelican, like the Pelican Cases company. They're actually venturing into the world of preparedness as well, and they reached out and asked if I would have their CEO on. So, of course, I said yes. I also want to remind you that the AI course will go on sale the Monday of the week of Christmas. And I can't, for some reason, ever remember exactly. It's the 20th. I always want to say it's the 21st. Maybe that's because this is the solstice. This is the day after the solstice. The 22nd, Monday the 22nd of December, the AI course will go on sale. If you are not yet registered for it and you want a shot at taking it, because we have over 800 people registered for it, you need to go to jackslaws.com. You'll see a little banner up at the top. Click on that. Fill out the form. And we'll email you and let you know when it's about to go on sale to remind you. And then it's going to be a race. Last time we put it on sale, it sold out in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes. So it's probably going to happen again. With that, take care, guys, and I'll catch you next week with another episode of the Survival Podcast. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.